Oh, Alvaro.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Nice to see you, David. How is life?
It's such a pleasure to see you.
Yes.
Is there as well.
Sorry?
I said Perna Sen is with us as well.
Okay, excellent. Yes, I saw that.
But I'm here. Hi, how are you?
Very Hello. Well, how are you?
I'm a little jet lagged. Just got in at 11 last night, but I'll try and see if I can sit in on this.
Good, okay. Good. Well, we hope you will. Trey is here in the room with me. I'm going to put her in the hot seat in a minute, but first I'm going to wait until 9 o'clock and make introductions.
Okay, very good. But,
we're recording. Shreya, is it okay if we record? Great, thank you. Okay. good, and there's Michelle. Hello, Michelle. And I know that Brunhilde is planning to join us from Iceland. And I know that Virginia is planning to join us from Buenos Aires. And so it's scheduled for an hour with the assumption that you'll speak for half an hour and 20 minutes, half an hour. And then here, you can put that right over there. Yeah, they'll dry out. Dump them out, so that we can then have a discussion. Okay. And let's see, it's not quite 9 o'clock. Alvaro, I'm looking forward to seeing you very soon.
Yeah, me too. I was going to say that. I will contact you for some details afterwards, David, to see if you can make this presentation in the commission work, okay?
Good. That would be great. I hope it will.
I'm sorry, there has been a lot of turmoil here because there is the new commission, but I will work on that now.
Very good. Okay. And Nicole, welcome. Okay. Michelle and Nicole, can you hear us? Nope. Out for the moment. Oh, and Costanza's here. Great. Yeah. Buongiorno. Or actually, I guess it's Bonasera where you are. I was in Florence just a few weeks ago and had dinner with Costanza.
Good line.
Yes.
Hey, yeah. Alvaro. Hi. And David.
Hello.
Hi, it's Costanza here.
Yes, we see that. We see your name. We don't see your face yet.
Oh, now you see my face as well.
We see your face. Very good. Yes. And in a moment, I'm going to give up this chair. to Juan Carlos. Hi, how are you?
So I'll mute myself and I'll take away the video, but I'm here online.
Very good. Glad to have you here.
Hi, everyone.
Hello, Carlos. How are you?
Very well. How are you all?
Very well. Great to see you.
Yeah, thank you for organizing this. Looking forward to it.
Yes. I'm going to go ahead and introduce Shreya, who really needs no introduction to this group. But of course, since we were all likely together, or at the various times we've interconnected in the last year or two, Shreya's moved to Oxford to a professorship in human rights and a fellowship at Kellogg College, which those of you who are English understand or British understand, and the rest of us are simply impressed by, and has published this wonderful new volume on intersectional discrimination from the Oxford University Press, and she can probably send you a coupon so that you can purchase it at a discount.
That is true.
Yeah, so you should connect with her for that purpose. Maybe we can put that out on the whole network. We will do that. Absolutely. Okay. And there's Anne. Hello, Anne. Welcome. So I'm now going to turn it over to Shreya, and I'm going to be sitting on the other side of the room, but I will join you for the question and answer. And thank you all for joining us. Yours.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me in Berkeley. This is actually my first time in David's office. And so now I can see all the grand setup we have here. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining. As David was saying, books are rubbishly priced, I have to say. So it's impossible to get a copy of them, because if we just keep buying monographs, where would we be? I mean, that would really take away from my coffee quota. And if we did manage to buy them and read them, I mean, there's so much which is being produced. So I believe the book talk is the best way to actually just say what exactly is the argument of the book, and what we're trying to do, and perhaps then have you ask some questions around what you think is covered, or if there are any answers that you've been looking for in the book. So what I thought I could do was introduce the argument of the book in this way. So I want to say three things which I observed, which led to framing the research question as it was, in terms of how exactly can discrimination realize intersectionality. So in framing that question, what were the observations in and about the field of discrimination law and intersectionality? So what is it about intersectionality and its cross-section with discrimination law that brought me to write the book? So I'll say three things which I observed and what I did to respond to those three things, and what the book does in turn. But before I do that, I think the first thing to mention would be that the greatest and the biggest thanks to the group has been conveyed very importantly in the acknowledgements. The group has been central to how the book has been conceived, in terms of both thinking about why comparativism is important to discrimination law as a field, and then thinking about the field as a whole rather than just the jurisdictions that we see. So it's both a sense of rationalizing why we do look at different jurisdictions, but also then making sense of the field as a whole. Both of those projects could not have happened had we not had so many conversations that we have together with the group. So the study group is now the center. So many thanks to so many of you who've been really big part of the project. Thank you for your time. So what were the three observations, and what did I do about them in framing the threefold central argument that I'll say last? So the first thing which motivated me to write the book was there was what I noticed, a sense that intersectionality had made it, that everybody was using the word, it had become a buzzword, that it was really part of the left liberal lingua franca. It was how good people understood equality, and there was a real sense of this was now embedded in the discourse. And yet, it seemed that three things about that sort of understanding, which was very much on the surface, that okay, we get intersectionality, there were three things which seemed a bit odd. One was that even though we did seem to get intersectionality as a general term of reference, we hadn't quite kept up with the development since Kimberly Crenshaw's seminal piece in 1989, which I think Nicole's back. Hi, Nicole. So the development since 1989, when Kimberly Crenshaw had introduced the term. So what had happened since 1989 was not exactly something that we'd kept up with. And it was primarily because the intersectionality literature had proliferated so much and in so many contexts that it was hard to just make sense of the field since its sort of peak of being christened by Kimberly Crenshaw in 1989. And much of that sort of burgeoning of the field had happened in discrimination law in a comparative context. And it was sort of hard to pull these strings together. But what was also interesting about how intersectionality was being understood was that a lot of the histories of intersectionality of over 200 years of Black feminist and more recently critical race theory, a lot of that was getting lost in the more modern or international or transnational framing of it. It was as if the concept was getting more and more further away from its originating context, which was Black feminism. And it was clear that this was certainly the case in discrimination law, because not all cases of discrimination, especially those arising in comparative context, were speaking to the context of Black women per se. So the context had in fact become broader. But then there was the missing link theoretically, that what exactly did the Black feminist context bring to our understanding of intersectionality? And we seem to be going slightly further away from that. And then finally, so there's, of course, if we take 1989 as the moment when we introduced the concept of intersectionality, there's the before and the after, but there's also that moment itself. The fact that so much of Kimberly Crenshaw's own work was read in ways which probably were not the ways in which it was written. It was conceived as a radical project. And in both her 1989 piece and 1991 piece, there was a streak of ambition for transforming discrimination law, which had sort of dissipated over time in the way that we were reading intersectionality. So it was three things which happened in and around the way intersectionality was being understood. And I started the project about 9 years ago, which was how intersectionality had come to be in the 200 years of its history. Then how was it being imagined since 1989, so since Crenshaw introduced the concept, and what had happened to Crenshaw's own work itself. So with all of those sort of first set of observations, the first thing that the book set out to do in the first part, so chapter 1 and 2 really are just exhuming the history or the trajectory or the arc of the development of intersectionality in discrimination law. It's doing so with the purpose of positing what is salient about intersectionality and what it brings to people. So I identify going through these historical notions of intersectionality in these three phases, five things which are central to intersectionality. And I propose what is a rather wordy definition. It doesn't quite sound as well as it might read, but I'll test everyone anyway. So here's an attempt to offer five things in single sentence definition, what I think are the core sort of strands in intersectionality theory of the last 200 years or so, and bringing that out for the purposes of discrimination law. So it's specifically imagined as something which might help discrimination lawyers do the work that we do. So definition is, intersectionality illuminates the dynamic of sameness and difference. So the first part of the definition is this phrase, it's the dynamic of sameness and difference. We're looking at both what is similar and different at the same time and simultaneously. So it's the dynamic of sameness and difference in patterns of group disadvantage. The phrase patterns of group disadvantage is borrowed from the South African Constitutional Court, something which Justice Plato Regan spoke of for the first time when imagining what exactly is discrimination. And she was imagining it in terms of what are these motives that are recurring of disadvantage, which is what we pattern group disadvantage. But they're then based on multiple identities understood as a whole. And that's the crux of intersectionality. We're speaking of both the multiplicity of identities and the but we also want to look at them as a whole. The moment we say we want to think about intersectionality in gay men, we're thinking of the multiplicity of what those different identities are, not as a standalone identities, but as identities that are co-constituted very much with one another, to think about masculinity, for gay men is very much defined by sexuality. There are no exclusive categories of masculinity or sexuality. They're made together. So looking at them as a whole, as to what it does to that experience of disadvantage. And then finally, we look at them in their full and relevant context, the purpose of addressing and transforming them. It's just trying to press the relevance of context here with the sense that discrimination law everywhere looks quite different. So if everyone remembers Chimamanda Adichie's Americana, where she says that her heroine sort of sat in a plane in Nigeria, traveled to the US. She wasn't black in Nigeria, but she ended up being black in the US. And for someone from Nigeria, it was just like, how did I become black overnight just by stepping into the US? So I think intersectionality partly sort of brings home the idea that look at it in context. Blackness is not going to have the same meaning everywhere. Caste is not going to have the same meaning everywhere. Gender, no matter there are similarities across the board, context is going to dictate largely how that gender discrimination is experienced. And finally, the last sentence of the definition is that the purpose of intersectionality is to redress and transform those patterns of group disadvantage that we're thinking of. And that's the most significant part of intersectionality theory in the last several decades and as we know it, that it was a radical project. It was trying to unsettle the status quo, challenge it, and imagine something that is looking a bit different than that. So one of the ways in which this transformative project comes out is in Kimberly Crenshaw's own example, when she imagines inequality as a kind of basement, organized in a hierarchical, pyramidal sort of structure, that the broadest part of discrimination is the one which is at the bottom. So it's the basement below the floor of equality that everybody who is multiply disadvantaged is lying in, and everybody who's disadvantaged on one minus category is one at the top. So at the top, you're imagining straight white men, middle class, non-disabled, and then from every layer bottom, from that top of the hierarchy is somebody who's disadvantaged on more than one category. And the purpose, as intersectional theorists would say, is to really just jumble that entire framework. So how do we imagine the basement to come to the top and the top to sort of be diluted? What exactly is that project of imagining a transformative vision of discrimination law? So it was trying to push discrimination law to something more radical than it is today. So that's the definition that is offered. It's a long one, but it's sort of set out in five different strands to be bringing home exactly what has intersectionality told us about what we want to do about it in discrimination law. The second observation which directed part of the project of the book was that that since 1989, since the word was coined, and since the term became more relevant to discrimination law, of course it had been existing in critical race feminism before then, but since 1989, intersectionality was being addressed in discrimination law. So it wasn't just that in 1989, when Crenshaw was first writing about intersectional discrimination, say discrimination based on more than one ground, the fact that there wasn't much in 1989 when she was writing in discrimination law, but it seemed that since 1989, there was a bit happening. So it was a sense of there was movement around intersectionality, that more and more cases based on more than one ground of discrimination were being addressed by justices around the world as cases of discrimination, but they were not necessarily being addressed as a matter of intersectional discrimination. So between 1989 and now, sort of a 30-year period, what you see is a continuum of range of responses to intersectionality. So sometimes this intersectionality would be just simply dismissed as is, and the judges would be very traditional in their imagination of discrimination law and say that discrimination is only meant to be single access. But that was more of 1989 than today. Judges had evolved in their thinking. So they were thinking in terms of multiple discrimination, additive discrimination, combination discrimination, compound discrimination, overlapping discrimination, embedded discrimination. All of these terms have been used in the range of jurisdictions, especially as I see in the book. So UK, US, South Africa, Canada, India, EU law and ECHR. So in those range of jurisdictions, there seems to be a proliferation of vocabulary of discrimination beyond the idea of the single ground or the single access discrimination. So the project for this book then became mapping what is now the continuum of what we know as discrimination as against intersectional discrimination. To see that there's no longer just the binary of single and intersectional discrimination, that there are a lot of categories of how we think about discrimination. So chapter 3 of the book takes the reader through this continuum, going through a range of comparative jurisdictions to say, look, between the two ends of the continuum of single access as well as intersectional discrimination, the two on each side, there's a lot much more happening. And it's about our clarity of conceptualizing those different ways of thinking about discrimination, which help us actually hone in into what intersectional discrimination is. It's not that intersectional discrimination is simply one that captures intersectionality, but in the vocabulary of discrimination law, it is a category of thinking about discrimination, sort of a technical category which we as discrimination lawyers think when we think of going beyond discrimination on more than one ground. What does it mean? It could mean lots of things. It could mean multiple discrimination. But the fact that we don't think that's what intersectionality is an important question to be able to answer, to posit what intersectional discrimination is. So that was the second part of what the book is trying to do. The last, and in fact, this is the hardest part, is that there was a sense that in our own individual projects and as the discrimination law community, especially the scholarship of discrimination law, we'd all tried to respond to intersectionality within what we do. So there's a sense of within every project that we have, say if we want to understand what grounds of discrimination are, or if we want to understand what is the difference between single access direct versus indirect discrimination, or if we are interested in the question of comparators, or if discrimination lawyers are interested in the question of standard of proof or the burden of proof or standard of review, whether it should be proportionality or strict scrutiny. In each of those questions, we had captured some sense of not being able to address intersectionality. So individually, our projects were reflecting a sense of that intersectionality is relevant and we should do something about it. But there was still something about not being able to capture intersectionality in its entirety. And here's where the book was imagined in the form that it's currently is, to be written as about or as dedicated to intersectional discrimination per se and nothing else. It was a sense of imagining discrimination law as a very complex and sophisticated apparatus with very small connected cogwheels. So the structure of the apparatus, the cogwheels sort of need to simultaneously work. So each of the central aspects of discrimination, from what is grounds to what is discrimination to what is the test for discrimination, whether something is direct or indirect discrimination, how do we prove it, which competitors do we bring home, what's the burden of proof on each of the parties, what standard of review for justification should the court apply, what remedies are to be awarded. If we imagine discrimination law as this complex labyrinth, each of the central concepts of discrimination law need to be activated. So it was a sense of bringing together the individual efforts that we had made in the last 30 years and to really consolidate the response to discrimination law as a field and say that it's that no single magic bullet is going to help intersectional discrimination. Simply put, the project of realizing intersectionality in discrimination law will probably involve a holistic, comprehensive effort of reimagining discrimination law per se. The reimagination doesn't quite have to get rid of the logic of the field, but it has to really recalibrate the logic. Because we've imagined the entire apparatus of discrimination law is responding to the single access claim until now. But what if we take a claim based on more than one ground, which reflects the complexity of sameness and difference? If we take that claim as a central claim of discrimination law, what we call the paradigmatic case of discrimination law, how is the machinery of discrimination law going to respond to that claim? So the last part of the book, which is I think that the hardest part of the book, because it's just trying to deal with the entire body of discrimination law as a whole. But what it's really trying to do is recalibrate each of the central principles of discrimination law and reorganize the field around what is the now at this point in the last chapter imagined as what is the paradigmatic case of discrimination, which is intersectional discrimination. So those were the three observations or motivations that I wanted to respond to in the book, and responding to those three motivations ended up yielding a threefold central argument, which was one, that in order to capture intersectionality, we need to get the concept right. The concept can't be just gotten right from the moment of its christening. So it's not just understanding what Kimberly Crenshaw did in 1989 and in her 1991 work, but also what happened before her and what continued to happen after her. So it was the entire trajectory which needs to be captured in the definition of intersectionality for discrimination lawyers. The second part of the central argument is that once we know what that definition is for discrimination lawyers, then we need to map it against what discrimination itself is. And then we arrive at the continuum of thinking about different categories of discrimination. It's going through those different hoops that we come to see what intersectional discrimination is for itself. And finally, once we've done both this sort of conceptual and categorical work, we'll finally come to the point of realizing that the doctrine of discrimination law is quite dense and perhaps not the most amenable to intersectionality. So then imagining the entire field of comparative discrimination law doctrine and going through each of its central concepts to recalibrate them with respect to what is this concept of intersectionality and the category of intersectional discrimination. Thank you.
Questions?
Are there any questions? Thank you so much for joining in. It must be all kinds of odd times. It's sort of 9-ish a.m. in Berkeley, but I can imagine everyone else is closer to the evening.
It's a shy group. But I know there are comments, questions, ideas to bounce around here.
Yeah. Treya,
I have a question.
Please go ahead. Thank you.
I'm trying to imagine creating, amending a law here in the United States or in California and telling a lawyer what they have to prove to establish that there is intersectional discrimination. And let's just take two categories, race and sex. So it's not just that a woman is getting harassed because she's female, she's getting particularly picked on because the victim of the harassment is an African-American female. What would you say you need to do? What would you recommend to activists who are trying to amend the law to make that clear to the judge and the jury?
Right. I would do two things. The first would be to capture the essence of what exactly is the claim saying when it's saying that somebody is being harassed, not only because of their race or sex or both of them at the same time. So to explain in one sentence what's happening with that person is that the person is experiencing something which is similar to, say, other women as well as men of color. So it's to say that, look, what I'm facing as harassment is similar to both what white women face as sexism as well as what black men face as racism. It's not that I'm outside of the category of sex and race discrimination. But once you've said that I'm similar to both of these categories, to also say that what I'm experiencing as the claimant in this case is something which is also at the same time different from what the two possible groups are facing. So it's imagined, it's now seen as not very accurate, but I think the imagery of the Venn diagram always helps understand what sameness and difference in patterns of group disadvantages. So if you're imagining two cross-cutting circles, overlapping circles of race and gender, then we're imagining this portion where they overlap as something having quite similar to the categories of gender discrimination and race discrimination, but also something different. It possesses its own characteristics and it's to be able to say that somebody is experiencing something similar and different at the same time is the essence of the claim. That's what you want the judge to get. Now, how do you build that in terms of evidence? What kind of evidence is needed? So a standard kind of evidence in the US context would be just bringing forth comparators, which do the work. And the thing about the comparators is that they're always imagined. The problem with comparators is this: that they mirror comparators to be shown so that the claimant is same as the comparator that you're imagining in every way other than that one characteristic which you want to show is the reason for discrimination. It just doesn't work for intersectional claimants because there's more than one characteristic involved. So there's no but for which can be answered in a single characteristic. So it's not that it happened but for somebody's race, but you're trying to say it happened but for both race and gender. So the kind of comparative work that needs to be done is to map the nature of discrimination, which is same and different, to the comparators that you're bringing. So the answer would be bring a range of comparative evidence which relates to every possible group which the person can compare themselves to, and not necessarily mirror comparators in the sense of lacking one personal characteristic. It could be people who are differently situated based on their gender, race, as well as both of them. So thinking about white women, white men, as well as men of color, and showing how the experience of harassment is same and different from all three of them. It's using the entire range of comparative evidence that we can get to bring out the nature of intersectional discrimination. Often the response of discrimination lawyers has been, why can't we settle on one comparator group? Why can't we just use white men as our comparators? They wouldn't. But the problem with using just white men as the comparison is because we lose the intersection, the quality of the intersection that black women face something which is similar to women, which is what Me Too was trying to do. It's an intersectional movement where you're not saying that every woman experiences intersectional harassment which is different from the other. We want to be able to say that women face harassment. It may look different. It's exactly the intersectional argument Me Too is making. So it's not losing the complexity of our being able to relate to each of the groups, that there's something similar in the group that we are part of, but also different at the same time. So the one big suggestion would be just not using only white men as the comparators, because we lose what is very much a relational aspect of intersectional discrimination, that is framed as we experience discrimination as against one another in many groups that we are a part of.
May I add something? I would like to suggest that in addition, one, in terms of the statutory language, hi everyone.
Hi.
The statutory language, adding the phrase or combination thereof is all that's necessary to write it into the statute. And then in terms of the presentation of a claim, I think there are two additional things I would add. One is the lawyer's role in explaining the nature of the intersectional stereotype and the way in which black women, for the example that Trey is using, are perceived differently. The set of stereotypes that apply to Black women are different than either the set of stereotypes that apply to Black men or the set of stereotypes that apply to white women. They have their own, you know, discrimination law in the US since Justice O'Connor's opinion in Price Waterhouse has focused very much on the operation of stereotype. And that means, I think, that we should be educating judges and jurors about the nature of stereotype. Sometimes we can do it solely through argument. And sometimes I think we need expert witnesses to talk about the, you know, and they can be social psychologists or sociologists to come in and talk about the nature of stereotype and the nature of intersectional stereotypes. So that's what I would add to what I thought was a very good answer.
Okay, can I add to David's answer now? I think one thing to...
Turn it back to you. Yeah.
I think one thing to think about is that the touchstone of discrimination across comparative law is different, right? So sometimes courts are using the anti-stereotyping principle common in Europe. Sometimes they're thinking about prejudice, the combination of stereotyping or prejudice common in Canada, or we're thinking about what is subordination, or we're thinking about disadvantage, or we're thinking purely in dignitarian terms, or sometimes we're thinking about autonomy and substantive freedoms. I think the move to reduce discrimination as a category, which is sort of epistemically speaking to one kind of problem, may be problematic because we deal with discrimination across a range of grounds. And each of those grounds speak to a different kind of what is wrong about discrimination. So the wrongness of discrimination may be stereotyping, say in the particular case of women, or subordination in the case of women. But for persons with disabilities, we might be needing a more sort of autonomy-affirming, a dignity-affirming conception of discrimination. It might be a combination of a few for different categories. So religious discrimination may not necessarily fit stereotyping as much as it might fit the idea of disadvantage, that certain kinds of disadvantages attached to certain kinds of religions and the way that societies have historically sort of continued to develop in different spaces. So each of those grounds, I think, have a very different tenor in terms of what they're saying when they say that this is a ground of discrimination. The thing most useful for intersectional discrimination would be to not limit our idea of discrimination to one thing. I think there's a move, especially in the theory of discrimination law, to reduce discrimination to one thing. Is it about autonomy or is it about? And I think it's a helpful theoretical project, but it may not help intersectional discrimination, which will really span far many more senses in which discrimination operates and would need a larger theoretical berth to operate in. So I think the phrase, the patterns of group disadvantage and the focus on disadvantage, howsoever defined, it may be about stereotyping, it may be about prejudice, it may be about socioeconomic disadvantage, it may be about subordination, it may be about dignity, it may be about autonomy. The fact that disadvantage as a category sort of captures what, you know, Iris Marion would think the five faces of oppression, you know, keeping it broad, keeping it as broad as possible for it to be able to capture the entire birth of intersectional discrimination would be more beneficial than the project of sort of distilling it to one thing or the essence of intersectional discrimination.
Shreya, you looked at a bunch of different countries. Did you find one that had the best statutes, South Africa or Canada? Or?
So I think South Africa does have Section 9.3 of the Constitution, which has an open-ended list of grounds. It's also the longest list of grounds, and it does say that discrimination can be based on one or more grounds. So it's doing many things at once. It's recognizing the possibility of multi-ground discrimination, which may be interpreted as intersectional discrimination. It has an open list of grounds. So a category like weight discrimination coupled with gender or something may be extremely useful. And it's giving a very long list of grounds. So a lot of things like transgender status would be covered. The problem though is that I don't think, from what comes through in the research, is that statutory language, constitutional protection, they're just foot in the door. Whether or not they allow or see the possibility of intersectional discrimination says very little about whether we're going to do anything about it. So statutes, constitutions can be as open as the South African constitution, but that is not a surefire sign to actually realizing intersectional discrimination. A whole set of maneuvers are then needed, and which is why the book is sort of going through the whole hoops of an entire discrimination claim and saying that even in South Africa, it's a hit or miss. So the South African Constitutional Court would be quite resistant to seeing, say, something like employment status as a ground of discrimination, when it very well can be for certain kinds of statuses. So the case of prostitution is one, which is very much a status-based thing in terms of the disadvantage which comes through because you are of a certain occupation. But they wouldn't just see it. And the moment that possibility is not activated, you're not going to see gender-based dimensions of prostitution, you're not going to see the employment status dimension, you're not going to see poverty and intersectional discrimination. So a lot much more is needed than the statutory language. I think we often focus on legislative change, constitutional amendment, but that's, from what comes through, is that that's more of a red herring than an actual answer to intersectional discrimination.
Can I ask something, if no one else? Yeah, so just a quick question. So I'm now in Spain, and here, even the, let's say, traditional anti-discrimination law framework is quite underdeveloped. So often even judges are very reluctant to find single ground-based discrimination. Do you think strategically it would be best for us to move straight into intersectionality, or try to let this model of more traditional grounds settle in and then make the transition?
I mean, look, we've got nothing to lose now. It's clear that discrimination law is being set backwards in almost every other country we can imagine, not just Spain. So, I mean, there is nothing lost in being more radical. And I think part of the reason for why discrimination law as a project may be a bit stalled is that I think we were a bit too traditional for some time. We thought that, you know, the early successes of the 70s and the 80s would hold us good stead. And maybe, I think, imagining that the response should be that we should be more radical, I won't think that would be misguided. I think it's seeing that what the project that we've imagined until now is probably flailing slightly because we haven't been radical. So I think if you think that being radical may be sort of not causally linked to the problem, then that might be wrong. I think the fact that it's a failing project may be identified as sort of the cause of not having looked at intersectionality sooner. So we could try. Okay. Is there any other question? Then maybe perhaps we can...
If really no one else wants to add anything, we will stop. But I just want to be sure that's the case.
Yes, hello to you, and thank you very much. I'm sorry I participated so late, but so I missed almost most of it, but thank you anyway.
Thank you for joining. Well then, fantastic. Have a very good evening, everyone.
Very good.
I shall turn you to David.
We'll be back. I can't remember on the schedule. I think that we have a workshop on some element of comparative disability law.
Yes.
As soon as it's either